We are going to be recording this, and it will be out in the public about a week from now. We're going to take this just the same way that we would do a podcast, except that these folks would be on a little TV screen and we'd be doing it remotely. But we're going to have some fun, and we're going to talk a little bit about where the healthcare industry is going. So if you're ready, we're ready. Healthcare touches nearly every American. It consumes nearly one-fifth of our economy, and somehow it manages to be simultaneously essential, expensive, innovative, frustrating, and misunderstood. From individual coverage to employer plans, from Medicare to self-funded strategies, every part of the system is connected. And it changes in one corner, create ripple effects almost everywhere. So where does the health insurance ecosystem stand today? What's driving it? What's threatening it? And what's coming next? Let's get briefed.
This is the Benefits Brief, the official podcast of the National Association of Benefits and Insurance Professionals. Your fast track to what you need to know to stay sharp, informed, and ready to deliver for your clients. And now, here's your host, former NABIP president and award-winning podcaster, David Saltzman.
And welcome to the inaugural episode of the Benefits Brief. You've already been introduced to Catherine Hempstead, who is the Senior Policy Officer for Healthcare at the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, and Mike Smith, who a lot of you know, has spent more than three decades helping agents, brokers, carriers, and consumers navigate almost every product in the known universe. Catherine, if you had to describe the health insurance ecosystem today in one or two sentences, what would it be?
One or two sentences, I think I would emphasize that our system is very expensive, increasingly so, and very fragmented, and increasingly so. And there are a lot of pain points for consumers, for providers, and really everyone involved. And, you know, compared to other countries, we spend a lot more, and in some ways, it seems like we have a lot less to show for it.
Is the system under strain, or is it just simply evolving?
Costs have been increasing quite a bit in the last couple of years, and the proportion of Americans who respond to surveys and say that paying for healthcare is their leading household economic problem is rising. More than half of households in almost any survey you look at, whether it's Gallup or Kaiser or anything else, are making that comment, and it's been increasing over time. And we just saw the report of the actuary. Prices have gone up. We saw the Milliman Medical Index. The cost of an average employer plan went up 7.9% between 2025 and 2026. So it doesn't seem like more of the same to me, but I also am not really sure how we're going to get ourselves out of this.
Good answer. Mike, you've been around this for a long time. You've dealt with almost, as I said, every product that there is out there. What's the biggest change you've seen in how Americans shop for and use coverage?
Well, there's been a lot of change. Probably the most significant was the ACA, because as many of us know, our organization used to be referred to as health underwriters. We'd go in the field and we would underwrite policies, and the ACA changed that. It made it guaranteed issue, as we all know. So that was probably one of the more significant changes. But it's almost as if it was chapter two of what was the expansion of Medicare Advantage in, 2003 or so, when we passed MIPA. So there's been a number of significant shifts that have moved the needle more towards a government-funded taxpayer dollar type of a system.
Has that changed in large measure how Americans shop and how they use their health care?
I do believe it has. Shopping is kind of a tough way to describe it, because most of the people will just go and try to find what is the cheapest plan. But when you can go to healthcare.gov and get a $0 premium, I think you're probably not really shopping for anything. You're just trying to pick a plan that offers your doctors and your drugs. So the way people enroll, not shop, for insurance is much different than it was 20 years ago.
That's the truth. Catherine, consumers say healthcare is too expensive. You alluded to this, too complicated and too unpredictable. What are the drivers? What's driving that frustration?
I think one of the things that sets us apart from other countries that we might otherwise compare ourselves to is that we spend a lot more for healthcare services. So hospital costs have been rising and rising, even though we don't have to do as many inpatient things, and there are increasingly other things we can do that are a little bit less intensity, but our population's aging, so sort of in the aggregate sense, we are spending a lot as a nation with hospital care. And then prescription drugs, obviously they're not so much that, it's important to realize it's not like a zero-sum game. There are new treatments, and there are things, it's not just we're paying more and more for the same stuff, but there's a lot of new therapies and new developments, and brand drugs cost a lot of money. So when the Office of the Actuary report came out, I mean, it was notable that the share of spending that is for prescription drugs has, you know, has increased a lot and has continued to increase. So I think that those are some of the biggest pain points.
Mike, is there a trust deficit among Americans as well when it comes to their health care?
I do think there is. And maybe we had to turn it back on the people that are buying the insurance and saying, you got to actually own up to your side of the bargain, too. Do they trust their doctors? Do they trust their health insurance company? They're fighting with prior authorizations. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the things that we're asking them to do, like, hey, maybe take care of yourself. Go get your preventive care checkup, and even to the point where we're giving them money and incentivizing them to do that. So trust is kind of a hard thing for me to admit to. I think responsibility might be a better way. There's two parties in this. There's the insurance company, and then there's the patient. If you want to throw in the pharmaceutical industry and now the hospitals, you got all four of those in the same bed. It gets to be a kind of an interesting mix.
So with all of that said, how has the advisor's role changed in the last, let's say, 10 years?
You've really got to stay up to speed on what's going on in the marketplace every day. I mean, our inboxes are all crammed with information on the different regulations and legislation and things that are shaping and shifting. And all the time, things are constantly moving. And that's why I'm really glad that we have conventions like this where we can come and talk to our vendors to find out what is the cutting edge new technology or what is the new trend, whether that's away from group benefits to ICHRA. There's so many things that we're challenged with every day that we have to know. It's the best thing I could say is just to stay up to speed and educate yourself daily.
So are advisors becoming more strategic, or are they just handling more, or both?
Both, but they're definitely having to become more strategic. It's just necessary in order to survive. I often say the more complicated things become, the more necessary a good broker is to getting into the weeds with their clients and really solving those problems. I don't know how people would do it without a broker.
Catherine, is there one policy issue that's having a big impact that maybe consumers aren't as aware of as they should be?
Well, Mike just mentioned ICHRAs, which is something that we're really interested in too. It's, you know, it's one potentially really large scale kind of health reform change that's already, you know, it's already in effect. I mean, there isn't a big interest in codifying it and thinking about, you know, what it could look like, you know, under different scenarios. But I think it is attracting a lot of excitement both for small business, but also sometimes larger employers. It's very, very difficult to get good data on who's really enrolled in ICHRA and how much enrollment there really is and how much we're seeing in 2026. And I think in the sort of short run, the individual market is under a lot of strain because of the expiration of the enhanced premium tax credits and the exits and the higher costs. So it seems like that, you know, in the short run might make ICHRA a little bit of a tougher sell. But in the long run, it's potentially a really interesting policy because it could chart a path out of group coverage for, you know, for more and more employers, which would really put more people in a context where they're shopping for individual products, working with brokers. And, you know, when you think about Medicare Advantage and Medicaid and the individual market, you can sort of see that the share of people that are buying individual products is really growing.
Mike, is it a tough sell, or are people starting to see it in the field as a way out?
The ICHRA concept?
Yeah.
It's not a tough sell. It's all about affordability. And the employers right now, they're enjoying a nice tax break by being able to pay for and deduct the health insurance policies for their employees, as well as the employees receive their benefits income tax free. In theory, we're sort of just shifting the dollars away from, I'm not going to be able to tax deduct a group health plan, I'm going to be able to sort of reimburse you on a tax favored basis for an individual plan. It's a complex thing, and again, I said what I just said. I think brokers need to really stay up to speed. Who's to say ICHRA's not going to make it? I don't know. I just know one thing. there were pensions back in the 60s and 70s that gave way to the 401k. And they said that wouldn't happen either.
They also birthed ERISA.
That's right.
And the nonsense that was going on with those pension plans. So, and that obviously affects us more and more and more today. And we'll touch on that in a little bit. Question for both of you. What should benefits professionals be watching over the next 12 months? Catherine, we'll start with you.
Well, I think if they're in the individual market, there's really a lot to look at. I mean, there's a push to get people into really low actuarial value plans, you know, with enormous out-of-pocket exposure for people. And I think, you know, there's even the promotion of catastrophic plans and things like that, which for a lot of people, it's really not the right choice. So I think brokers, I mean, I'm not a broker. I think that'd be a very hard job, but a very, very important job. But I think that you would need to really make sure the person you're working with understands what their out-of-pocket is going to be with some of these different, you know, metal levels. And so many people with medical debt are insured, you know, and people blame insurance companies for medical debt, which, you know, isn't necessarily fair in particular, but I think it's because so many people feel overexposed to cost, even though they're insured. So I think that that would be something I'd be looking at a lot. And I'd also just be watching exits in markets, which are unfortunate, but they're happening. And so people in many parts of the country are going to have fewer choices in the individual market in 2027.
Mike, same question. What should benefits professionals be looking at? We talked about ICRAs. We talked about some of the other pieces. What do you think they should be looking at that we haven't touched on?
I think right now it's important to focus on retention because there's so much uncertainty right now. And as Catherine mentioned, with plan exits and things that are happening that are out of our control, I think being proactive with communications with your existing book of business is very important. And while you're having those conversations, you're also putting yourself on an exhibition that says, I'm an expert in this area, and people talk about their health insurance all the time. So if they're out there really being proactive about communicating with their book of business, what do you think the book of business is going to tell their friends to do? Call David, call Catherine, call Mike. So activity breeds more business.
What policymakers, Mike, what do policymakers in the media misunderstand most about the Medicare market today?
Gosh, that's a loaded question. We'll have another conversation about this.
That's why I directed it to you.
You know, it's easy for the insurance companies to get knocked around because anytime something gets denied, a claim or prior authorization, you know, you can go run to the press and the press is going to beat the drum and it's going to make people angry, angry enough to where we actually have someone on trial for killing an executive of a health insurance company. And we've gotten to that point, we have a real problem. So I would tell people to take a deep breath and educate themselves on their Medicare options and use a broker to help them really understand the differences to what's the most suitable need, what's a compliant suitable need for their health benefits and their drug benefits.
Catherine, offstage we were talking a little bit about long-term care and about disability income and whatnot. What do you think the biggest challenge facing seniors is maybe over the next decade?
That's just a whole unfinished chapter in our sort of social insurance / safety net ecosystem that, you know, there's always a contingent of people that say, you know, we need to go to a more of a universal coverage system, and then we also need to address the long-term care. There's a huge problem with people having insufficient savings for healthcare and their retirement. People are living longer than they used to, which is great in some ways, but they sometimes outrun their savings. And we, you know, I'm thinking a lot about the impending solvency issue with Social Security and Medicare Part A, which is, I think, going to make people think about our social insurance approaches and what are we going to do to fix what we have and can we build from that? I mean, there was the attempt during the ACA to have the class system, which obviously failed. But I think it's a huge problem, and there's a very small amount of private long-term care insurance that's way too expensive for most people. And there's, unfortunately, not a middle, and all too many people have to exhaust all their assets and go into Medicaid at the end of their lives. And there's really, not a middle space for people to go to. So I think that that's certainly something that it would be great for policymakers to address.
You know, Catherine, a lot of people watch Robert Wood Johnson, both in politics and out, and they try to be informed by some of the studies and the work that the group does. What do you think is the biggest disconnect between policy intent and consumer experience?
Well, I think what Mike was saying about prior authorization, I think is a really great point. And I do feel like we're in a little bit of a mini HMO backlash kind of mode now, where people are really, really fed up with some of the practices of insurance companies. I think prior auth is sort of the poster child for some other things. And I think there's a, you know, a real disinclination to trust insurers, and there's a lot of anger among consumers about, you know, insurers. So some of it I think they've earned by things they've done that have been reported on, and some of it I think they're just sort of catching flack for a system that's not serving people well. But at the end of the day, we do need to contain costs if we want to expand coverage so that everyone has access to affordable care. And one of the ways to do that is by managing utilization. And there are probably better, more transparent, more appropriate ways to do it. But I think that, you know, some people might think that, like, oh, you know, we don't really need to manage utilization at all. But, you know, we definitely do. And there are different ways to do it. I mean, there's upstream ways, making people healthier, making sure people get preventive care and vaccines, things like that. And then there are, you know, ways to maybe incentivize providers to, you know, not just provide services, but to try to get quality outcomes and keep people out of high intensity situations. But then there's also sometimes managing utilization at the individual level. And I think in some ways the skirmishes between providers and insurers have moved a little bit away from rates. And now I think there are a lot about intensity of service provision and coding and prior authorization. And as always, it's patients that get caught in the middle when, you know, when these two entities you know, are sort of clashing over how much to pay each other. So I think it's understandable that people hate it, but we also do need to think about what is the way to try to contain cost growth so that everyone can have access to care.
Mike, as a longtime NABIP member, you understand that legislation and policy is kind of our wheelhouse. A lot of members very, very involved with that. What's a healthcare policy idea that sounds great in Washington but really struggles in the real world?
Oh, let's raise taxes and make everybody have Medicare Part E, long-term care. You know, that's probably the one thing I would say to that question is that, you know, they think that if you just raise taxes and bring in more money that it's going to solve more problems. Maybe they have something right there. I don't know. I've just seen too many times where the public option failed more than the private option. But what Catherine was saying here about utilization, a lot of these things regarding the prior authorization center around long-term care. And long-term care is a completely different animal than Medicare. So there's got to be some real discussions at the congressional level to solve the problem of long-term care. The new phrase should be T80, because your baby boomers are not T65 as much as they're T80 these days. And that's about 3 years away from a big long-term care claim. We have a deficit in healthcare providers as well. We have a real challenge ahead of us, and I'd like to see a lot more attention put on that.
So kind of expanding on that, what does ACA Marketplace get right today, and where does it still fall short?
I think they got right the idea of covering pre-existing conditions, perhaps also even giving guarantee issue. While that might seem kind of anti-insurance because people don't get insurance because they're sick, right? But that's exactly what the ACA did. I think they got that right. I'm not sure exactly if they got it all right, though. I'd like to see even maybe a high-risk type of approach where maybe the insurance companies were on the hook for the first $50,000 or $100,000, and then maybe where there was an attachment point to where there's a high-risk type of a pool where those very sick individuals could transfer into that, because what we're doing is chasing away the insurance companies. We have a very unstable market in the under age 65 individual family plan market. We need to get that stable and bring more entrants into the market and give us more choices. So there's a lot we can unravel with that.
Catherine, how do you make a high-risk pool work? A lot of people have died on that hill, states and other organizations, and it just seems to anti-select against itself until you're left with only a whole bunch of really sick people.
Yeah, I'm no fan of a high-risk pool, to be honest. I think some states have used reinsurance to kind of deal with higher-cost claims. I mean, I think one of the best things for the individual market would be if we could get more members from group, you know, and that's why I feel like ICHRA in the large group could be very helpful. I mean, I think what the ACA I completely agree with Mike. The guaranteed issue, you know, community rating, obviously that's the way ERISA plans work. So why do we want to have a two-tier system where people who are self-employed have to be underwritten for health insurance and people that happen to work for a large employer don't? There's nothing fair about that. So I think that was exactly the right way to go. And in a way, it's like shocking to imagine that that once wasn't so, and that was a huge gap that needed to be filled. But, I mean, unfortunately, the ACA didn't really do anything about cost containment, and it continues basically to just pay providers commercial rates, and you know, it's just created more sort of, you know, fragmented segments of health insurance, and it didn't do anything to really bring sort of aggregate costs down. And you know, people can have different opinions about the enhanced premium tax credits, but people that make over 400% of federal poverty who are not rich, that's an individual making $62,000 a year, were, you know, before the enhancement, got nothing. And they would be basically being asked to sort of pay retail for health insurance. And it just wasn't affordable for lots of, you know, lots of normal working people. So I think that I'm of two minds. I mean, I think we need to do something to make really those offers truly affordable for everybody, but at the same time, the actual cost of those plans is very high because there's no real cost control on what providers are getting paid. So from a societal standpoint, it was very expensive to keep paying those enhanced premium tax credits. So, you know, I think we need to do things to bring prices down so that we can actually provide affordable offers to everybody. So I think that means we need to do more about cost containment.
You know, we've had some talk already in the convention about AI, and there are more sessions. Alan Katz is doing a session, one of the breakout sessions about AI, and it's every place. So as technology improves, Mike, do human advisors become more important or less important?
Absolutely more important. I think there's a healthy kind of a sandwich where the AI can set it up at the beginning, the first slice of bread, and then the meat comes in the middle where the broker comes back with the recommendation that the AI helped prepare and then delivers that package back. So that little sandwich of opportunity there, which the AI on the front and back side with the broker in the middle directing traffic.
Catherine, 5 years from now, put your future hat on and your gaze into your crystal ball. What does a healthier, better functioning health insurance system look like?
One that's more universal. One where providers are getting paid more the same price for all the patients that they see. One where we don't spend as much money on administrative costs. Especially working age people can churn between Medicaid, the ACA marketplace, employer coverage, and it's so time consuming and wasteful, and that's all money that we could be saving. So that's what my future me wants, and it depends if there's just enough sort of pain and frustration and resolve to really get there.
Mike, what's the biggest obstacle that's going to stand in the way of what Catherine's envisioning?
Money, just tax dollars. Yeah. I mean, you know, we could shift dollars around. I mean, we always argue about trying to save the employer exclusion, and I agree with that. However, that's one of the largest cost items in Congress today, and they're just sitting back going, wow, if we could get rid of that, we'd have a lot more money we could spend in other places. And I think that could be a cost shift over to some other area like Medicare or Medicaid. And now you're dancing right around the idea of having a national health care plan, a universal health care plan, and at some point you have to throw your hands up and say, well, okay, we've tried everything else. Maybe that's what we should do.
So looking at 2035, what part of today's health insurance system isn't going to exist anymore?
Ooh. I think that there'll be all of the types of insurance that we have today will still be in existence in 2035. You're still going to have options. The question really is, what new options will we have? Will short-term major medical plans become creditable coverage? Will COBRA become creditable coverage? I mean, we've got a little bit of a problem with cleaning up some of the stuff that's happened, unintended consequences, if you will. I think we need to address some of those factors first. So maybe not so much a product that's going to be different, but perhaps a regulatory or legislative fix.
So what should benefit professionals do now to prepare? You got all these people in the audience. They're the folks who are going to have to deliver whatever it is that's out there. What can they and what should they be doing to prepare?
I think they need to be diversified, because I'm not going to bet on anything in this world. It's changing too quick. I'm not here to spell out the demise of health insurance. But if I'm only counting on health insurance, I'm probably building a house on sand. You better get diversified.
So we've got about 5 minutes left. Let's do a lightning round. Catherine, what's the biggest myth Americans believe about health insurance?
What's the biggest myth that Medicare covers long-term care?
Mike?
High five. Yeah, we've got to do a better job of educating people about what Medicare doesn't pay for, and that's exactly what we were talking about earlier with utilization. We've got to know that there's going to be a point somewhere in the first 30 to 60 days where that claim is going to become chronic and long-term, not acute care, and that's got to be solved.
Catherine, what's the biggest thing that nobody's paying attention to right now that might sneak up and bite them in the butt?
The biggest thing that no one's paying attention to that might, I think probably very expensive gene therapy. I mean, people are thinking about it, but it's gonna bite them in the butt.
Even though pharmacogenomic testing has come down exponentially in price.
Yeah, but some of the therapies are still 60
So you're talking
years.
About taking that and then implanting it into creating designer drugs or drugs particularly for one individual's genome.
Yeah, and I think, you know, there needs to maybe be some different way to think about sharing risk around things that are super expensive and are curative but are rare.
Mike, I know this may frighten you. If you were HHS secretary for one day, what's the first thing you change? I knew that was going to be your reaction.
I would pull all the pharmaceutical firms into the room and say, get your act together, because there is a lot of fat in that equation and it needs to go away.
All right, Catherine, we're now going to make you HHS secretary for a day. What's the one thing? What's the first thing that you change?
Oh, that's so easy. I would, I wouldn't be able to do it, but I'd try to eliminate work requirements that were just added to Medicaid. But what I do, you can't, but Congress has to do that. So what I would really do is start acting normal about vaccines.
Catherine Hempstead and Mike Smith, thank you both for helping us better understand the focuses and the forces shaping healthcare coverage, affordability, consumer access, and the future of our industry. And to all of you, thanks for joining us for this special live edition of the Benefits Brief. And until next time, you've been briefed.
Stay ahead with the Benefits Brief. Subscribe on Apple Podcasts or Spotify, or catch every episode in your member-exclusive Washington Update each Friday. To learn more about how NABIP helps you succeed or to become a member, visit NABIP.org. That's NABIP.org.